So if you turn all the lights out and it's dark, you know it's dark. And if you turn all the lights on, you know it's light. Right? Dark and light change, but the knowing is light. Now that what is that sense of being present to the way things are, which isn't dependent on the lights being on or off? So the light in the room is dependent on whether it's daytime or nighttime. But you know it's dark and you know it's light, don't you? And that kind of unchanging quality of conscious presence is where we find our true freedom. And that's what Buddhism is always like. Some of Buddhism, we're always emphasizing change, right? Like if you say permanent to a Buddhist, they'll look at you, you know, like you can't say that, you're a Buddhist. And yet, the liberation that the Buddha was talking about was the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the permanent. And sometimes I think in Buddhism we only get 50% of the deal. And the reason that the Buddha was pointing to impermanence was don't rely on the impermanent for happiness or freedom. We have to deal with the impermanent. You know, my coffee got cold, so I got it warmer. And so on and so forth. But you know, the whole thrust of the Buddha's teaching was liberation from impermanence. You know, liberation from that. So it's not a judgment around the conditions of the world, it's just saying they're limited. It's not a judgment against beauty or inspiration or these things, it's that you just can't rely on them. You can't rely on inspiration. You just can't. You know, I've tried. So inspiration is nice, and we all like inspiration, but to rely on it would, of course, you have trouble with its opposite, disappointment, right? So the awareness, conscious presence, includes both. It includes both inspiration and disappointment, right? And when you get that, then you can enjoy the inspiration, but when it changes and it's disappointing, so disappointment feels this way. And that's a true refuge. You know, inspiration cannot be a refuge. Good health cannot be a refuge. Eggs on toast is not a refuge. But it's nice. So it's not to deny nice, and but to say is not. Our spiritual aspiration is something more profound than just the changing conditions of aesthetics or emotional uplift or all the other things that we like. And as many of us, how many people are on old age pension? There you go, huh? It's all downhill from now on. So, I mean, you know, people talk about old age being this kind of horror show coming up, right? And we kind of catastrophize, you know, I'm going to be in an old people's home and blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, the awareness is not, it's not a function of age. Now, you know, you can say, well, dementia and Alzheimer's and those things are a function of age. I don't know. You know, I might be able to report for you. I'm not sure. But just like bad hips and bad knees and the bad throat and so on, they're just part of nature. And the nature's changing, conditioning. But awareness or conscious presence, that's really mysterious, isn't it? It just knows. It just knows the way things are. And that's why we call it a refuge. When we take refuge in Buddha knowing Dharma, it's the sense of suchness. This moment is just the way it is. The kind of like Philip saying the refresh button. It's just this way. And that's what I would encourage us to kind of continually return to. It's just this way. Which is a stopping or an awakening to the moment. It's not a commentary. It's not a judgment. It's not anything really. It's not intellectual. So liberation is not more information. You know, liberation is not an accumulation of knowledge. Knowledge can be helpful as a pointing to, but knowledge can be a trap too. You know, where you think that, well, I just do another Buddhist course and learn some more Buddhist concepts and get another list going, which is what monks do. somehow I'll be more in line. But not necessarily. It might be just be like collecting baseball cards. It's just more information. So how do we use information to come back to the same thing again and again and again? And so the teachings for me are ways of awakening to this very mysterious thing called conscious presence, or whatever way you want to call it, awareness. Ajahn Sumedho's now is the knowing. Different teachers talk about it in different ways. That's the principle. That for me is that's the kind of real principle that I try to work from and teach from. And then within that, you can see that then anything is okay, really. And what the practice is how can I remember this sense of awakened presence? So one could see that, like, generosity is going to be really helpful for this practice, whereas mean-spiritedness probably won't be so helpful. Right? If I'm really mean-spirited, then I'm going to get in line before you so I can get my coffee. I heard the coffee machine died today or something. So mean-spiritedness is kind of like, how can I get this for myself? And that's going to make me attached to conditions, to the condition realm of how I want it. Whereas generosity, if you look at generosity is I've got space for you. You know, we can all do this together. You can have half my cup of coffee or whatever. So generosity actually allows me to be more present to the way things are. So the abandonment of greed, hatred, and delusion is not simply a kind of moral thing. It's just a strategic kind of practice so that we can be free. Because if I'm always angry at you or critical of you or judgmental of you, my mind is caught up in the conditioned realm, my judgment of you. Whereas if there's compassion and my relationship to you is empathetic, then that gives me more space. Oh, yeah, you're just going through a hard time. May you be well. Rather than you're going through a hard time, get out of my life. Yeah. So compassion and generosity and renunciation and these different things, they're really the foundation for freedom. But they're also happy. That's a nice thing. At least the foundation for freedom isn't mean-spiritedness, which is a relief. So it's a good deal either way. That's the beauty of the teaching. It really is a liberation from the psychological things which cause us suffering, but then they in themselves become foundations for something even more profound, even more profound. So as I was saying, like this morning, I said, like just now, like any discomfort you get, or sense of disorientation or restlessness because you can't get on the internet or whatever things we're used to doing, just use that discomfort as practice. So discomfort feels this way. In your sitting practice, you feel restless in the body or something. Oh, restlessness feels this way. So using everything to deepen awareness, everything. And the negative, obviously, is the harder to sustain awareness around. Huh? So it's not you don't have to feel inspired or whatever. Just you feel what you feel. And it all belongs. It all belongs. So the two metaphors I like to use are the two images I like to use. Because we learn a lot by example, don't we? We learn from narratives and stories and metaphors and similes. These are the ways at least my mind works. Something about the mind liking it. So the image I was talking about was the image of the wheel. So you think about a wheel and the rim of the wheel. Imagine that. And then you have the axis or the hub. Right? And so the rim of the wheel, you're drawn to it, and then you go around like that. That's known as samsara. And it's just reacting all the time. And then the center knows the rim, but doesn't go out to it. So all things on the rim point back to the center. All feelings of love and hate point back to awareness. But if I go out to the rim, then I get drawn to feelings of love and hate, and I spin around. So whether I'm happy here or unhappy, it all points to awareness. So we say all conditions take you to the unconditioned. if you have that mode of attention, which is great. So awareness is not conditioned. It's not hot or cold. It's not big or small. It's not male or female. It's not young or old. It's not good hips or bad hips, right? It's not good knees or bad knees. It's not an upset stomach or a non-upset stomach. It's just conscious presence of the way things are. In any condition, I can feel really annoyed at someone and think, why are they doing that? And say, ah, this is what it feels like to be annoyed. And it takes me back to the center. And then the other, oh, you're fantastic, you're an amazing person. Ah, takes me back to the center. But if I choose, you're fantastic, you're terrible, then I'm on the rim. And on a conventional level, I have to choose, right? So we have conventional truth. We talk about conventional truth, and we have what liberating truth. So conventional truth, I have to choose. I have to put on my coat because it's cold, and I can choose if I want milk or no milk, and so on. It's not that we don't choose, but that which is beyond that kind of center of knowing, is I think what spiritual life is about. Right? Spiritual life is about. So that's one image I like to use a lot. I used it for much of this winter retreat that we had. We have, you know, as a monk, it's a good deal. We just did a 3-month retreat. It's really a good deal. Anyway, so that's one, you know. So if you think about it, like, no, don't think about it too much. But if you observe attention going into something like thought or idea or plan or resentment or regret or an emotional feeling of or a physical feeling of pleasure or pain, these are all moving. They're changing all the time according to nature. They're just natural. So annoyance is natural. Happiness is natural. Pain is natural. These are part of nature. They're moving. And that which knows that conscious presence, that's the axis. So that's one image I like to use. But the other image is one where awareness includes everything. So like this morning, I was sitting, and I could feel that people were coughing, right? And I could hear the sound of the stove crackling. So consciousness was producing a sense of me sitting here and people out there, a sense of space and a sound in space. But that was all happening in awareness. That's all happening in awareness. A very sense of I'm sitting here and you're there. Like my perception of you out there, it's true. But that's all happening in awareness. So the image there is that awareness is space. So like if you consider this room, you have the objects in the room, faces, fan, heat, your thoughts, and then you have the space. And the space includes everything. And that's an image. It's not kind of I'm not talking about quantum physics or anything like that. But it's an image. And if you say consciousness is space, or space, consciousness is space, or space is consciousness, say, and you say that this whole experience is taking place in awareness, what does that do to your mind? To me, it makes me, I have to kind of let go of looking at things. I have to take my attention away from my thoughts, the movement of the fan, the color of the carpet, the heat of the room. I just have to relax into conscious knowing of space. And then everything is taking place in that. And that's non-attachment. That's non-grasping. And if you combine those two images, that everything is pointing to awareness, and that awareness includes everything, you've got a really neat little package, which you can develop for a lifetime. And I'd like to do noble silence for the rest of the retreat, but I'll have to fill in a few gaps. But there, you know, simple images like that, it's different than techniques. you know, techniques quite often are kind of things that you kind of build up and you build up and you build up and so on. But I think if you don't get the principle of non-grasping and non-becoming, if you don't get that principle right, then there's always a sense of me becoming something. But notice this isn't becoming. You're not becoming a kind of card-carrying Buddhist. You're not even becoming enlightened. But you're just knowing the way things are. And that is enlightenment, I should think. Huh? If you trust it. You don't trust it, you think, well, I don't know. And then, okay, you don't know. And that's what it feels like, you don't know. Oh, he's just pulling a fast one on me because he doesn't know how to teach. Maybe. You don't know. But all you know is it's doubt. You know, it's just... I don't know. You can, well, you have to prove it. But I would say trust, you know, like trust in that. Trust in your own innate ability to know, rather than trying to figure everything out or become something different. This is the kind of, we call that, in dependent origination, we say avijja paccaya sankhara. With ignorance as condition, there are these kind of formations, say ego formations as a way of talking. And what is ignorance? Ignorance is that I'm someone who has to become something else. I have to go somewhere else and become something else. Time. This morning, before the meeting, at breakfast, Philip made me a cup of coffee, and I was drinking my coffee and looking at the shelves in this monks do these kinds of things. And I was just thinking, when is the next moment? I was looking at the shelf, when is the next moment? And you can't get it. It's just always present, isn't it? When is the next moment? So there is chronological time, but we always live in the present. It's a kind of paradox. So please come on time, for sure, right? but this is, I think, what spiritual practice is about. It's not denying conventional reality and conventional time and so on, but what is it about consciousness that we only know the present moment? I mean, it's really interesting that. So just watching, I said, oh, when is the next moment? It's actually very peaceful. Because what I usually do, you know, I anticipate that I have to say something. That's why I get my rice first. Or something like that. So then if I attach to anticipation, you know, then there's the sense of time. Me, you know, I'm supposed to be saying something, and they, you guys, they're out there, and I, and that creates a sense of self, right? And then from that sense of self, of me having to perform or talk or whatever, there's a sense of, oh, the future. And then there's a sense of anticipation. And there's a sense of failure or success and so on. But in any given moment, I say, oh, this is what it feels like to be anticipating having to say something. And that's timeless. And that always brings me back to the power of now, as, you know, that kind of language we have now. And that is the one of the primary and central themes of religious practice is learning to abide in knowing the present moment just as it is. And to see that the sense of self as a perception in time is just a perception. My mom died 2 years ago. It's true, but right now I just know it's a perception. That's all I know. And I'm not saying it's not true. But when you abide in that kind of knowing, this is just a perception, the sense of ego in time begins to die. And you begin to touch what we mean by the mind, which is empty of ego, empty of self, empty of becoming, and the peace of the kind of that kind of consciousness. I have all kinds of Viradhammo stories, and I've given them so many times. And I think, you know, it's been many years since those Viradhammo stories took place, some of them. I think, did that really happen? I think it's like another guy. And yet, it's a good story. And I'm sure I've embellished it. I don't know, how could you not? But I just know, oh, well. I don't know. I don't know if it's true. I do check with my fellow monks now. I go to Ajahn Sumedho and said, did that really happen? And it's interesting, it did happen, but he saw it slightly differently. It's just memory. Memory's that way. But just to know, memory is like that. So take something more difficult, like a resentful memory, or a painful memory, or a humiliating memory, or a remorseful memory that comes up. That's just a memory, right? Now, if I grasp that, and I go into some time reflection of, oh, it was terrible what happened to me, or it was terrible I did to someone else, and I don't see that as just memory, I'm bound by time and ego and self and suffering. But if I just see it as memory, even if it's painful, it's just a memory, it feels this way. That's the hub. That's the rim. That's the rim, isn't it? And oh, that's just memory. Memory feels this way. I'm back home again. Back in the timeless. The memory might have like powerful emotional feelings in it. You know, I might feel real, you know, maybe I had a really terrible falling out with someone 5 years ago, and it's still churning through my citta, my heart, and it comes up. And if I can just like say, yeah, pain feels this way, memory feels this way, then it processes through. It doesn't get stuck as a kind of rebirth. Right? It's just energy. It's painful, it's difficult, but it's just energy. And more one finds that one's real home is in that conscious presence to the way things are. And to do that with something painful, now that's what we call practice. You know, I feel something like some painful loss or whatever it is, just to be with that. So like with my mom, when my mom died, I was basically a basket case for 2 months after. And there was nothing wrong with it. I was just exhausted. You know, it had been 9 years of full-on caring. And Ajahn Kusala said, just go to your kuti. And I went to the monastery and had just a terrible two months. But why should it not be terrible? And I didn't, like, regret my mom dying. She was 96. She wanted out years ago. And both of us would sometimes read an article about someone living to be 115, and we'd both moan. So, no. The thought of it was appalling for both of us, you know. So she died, and it was natural, but I was exhausted. And so how should I feel but just a basket case? So this, you know, was my practice. This is what it feels like to be a basket case. But because I just knew that, and I trusted in that, and because I've been doing it a few years, it was okay. And then after 2 months, it lifted, and I just had so much happiness since, and so much joy about reflecting on my mom and my time with her, right? But if I hadn't, you know, if I hadn't had that practice, then I could have got depressed or whatever, I don't know. So this is a very, very profound practice. It's a very beautiful, very simple. It's very, very direct. Now it's the way it is. It's so obvious. Say, well, it must be more. So sometimes we think we have to beat ourselves up. You know, like let's say you say something to someone at breakfast and you kind of make some casual remark to them that they're doing something wrong. And then you come back up here and feel terrible remorse. And go, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done this. Don't go there. I just said something and this is the result. It feels this way. If you beat them up, apologize. But like, don't create a self where there is no self. Right? Don't go there. Don't create that. Just keep coming back to awareness of the way things are. Very simple. Very, very direct. Very direct practice. And then the other things we do, then if you do mindfulness of breathing, if you do body sweeping, you do metta practice, that all those practices to me are serving this one impulse, this one possibility. Rather than doing a technique now and kind of hammering away, putting in those hours, you know, really bearing with the pain, pushing through, so that on the ninth day you feel wonderful, right? Problem with that is you might not feel wonderful, and then you'll be disappointed and ask for a refund. But also it's wrong view, because it's about becoming. So you might be very clever, and you might accumulate more and more kind of calm states of mind, but as soon as you go back to the world, it'll crumble, it'll fall apart. But this practice does not fall apart. Conditions fall apart. This practice does not fall apart. And the more you understand that, the more you feel that's where your freedom is. So then, like, mindfulness of breathing is a great practice because it brings you back to the present moment. Practices of the heart, metta practice, is a great practice because it opens you to the present moment. A very necessary practice. Body sweeping is a great practice. Yoga, a great practice. But not to become. Not to become, but rather to remember the present moment. That's what we're going to do. So stretch your legs a bit and we'll do some sitting. Give some instruction. No. I can use the mic here, the amp maybe. Yeah. Do you think it's working? Is it amplified? Probably. Yeah. So whatever techniques you like to do and you find helpful and that you've developed, first and foremost is to make clear what the awake mind is and make that conscious, like the refresh button say. We're going to make conscious this moment before we try to accomplish anything or do anything. So that awakening of consciousness. So I use, as most of you know, I use listening a lot. So just begin by listening. Just bring consciousness to the listening function and become conscious of sound. So that the way I phrase that, become conscious of sound, is different than listen to a particular sound. So become conscious of sound. What I'm pointing to is a mind which is attentive to the moment and allowing sounds to become conscious, allowing sounds to come, present themselves, as it were. And then notice that way of conscious presence where you're not really, it doesn't really matter what sounds are there. Or if you're reacting to sounds, you can notice that too. But it's using sound to bring you back to the center of conscious presence. And then make that, really note that, what it feels like to be present. So what do you have to do? You have to let go of thinking and listen. And then notice this kind of consciousness where you're not looking for anything, so your eyes aren't straining to see something. You're including everything, allowing everything to be the way it is, sound to be the way it is. So there's no greed and no hatred. It's just presence. But also you're not deluded, so you're not caught up in sleepy states or thinking a lot. And there is conscious presence. And that's not something you have to become. It's something just you keep remembering. So even if the tractor starts up or the chainsaw starts up and now and the sound becomes perhaps unpleasant, that conscious presence to that doesn't change. It just knows the change. So this for me is it's kind of like riding a bicycle. This is balance. This awake presence, that's balance. And the bhavana, the practice, is to sustain that balance. It's like to ride the bicycle with whatever object of meditation one uses. So get the balance first. And then return to that. If you get all confused, return to just listening, knowing, very simple. So then in the same way, you can feel the body. So let the body become conscious. Feel the posture as it's resting on the chair or on the ground. Your feet, your legs, the thighs, buttocks, the weight of the body. Now let that become conscious. So don't squeeze your eyes kind of trying to focus on it, but let it become conscious. Then your spine, from the base to the neck. Let that become conscious. And the shoulders and arms, hands. Now just feel your hands, the warmth, pressure, vibration. Let your hands become conscious. Don't strain your eyes looking, let it just manifest. So the object changes, but conscious presence is the same. Feel your head. Feel your mouth. Let that become conscious. Feel your nose. And feel your eyes. And feel the whole body. Let the whole body just become conscious as sensation and vibration and warmth and coolness. So the feelings in the body are objects, and they point back to conscious presence. And they're included by conscious presence. And then within that bodily feeling, let the breath become conscious. And breath is something that's uncomplicated, happening here now. So you use the breath to help maintain conscious presence, one breath at a time. So it's like riding the bicycle. So as you practice in this way, your mind will obviously drift off and get sleepy and you start thinking about this and that. The most important thing is to remember what we're doing. We're coming back. We're not trying to get rid of thought, but we're seeing thought as an object. And we're returning to conscious presence, knowing the way things are. So it's a remembering rather than a becoming. It's like getting back up on a bicycle, remembering balance, and then riding one breath at a time as a kind of strengthening of this conscious presence. So that is, as you attempt to do this, you notice that your mind gets caught up with things. So then you can experiment. You can play around with the breath. You can make it deeper so you're more deliberate. So you just deepen the breath. But the whole object is conscious presence. So sometimes the breath becomes too shallow, too refined. So then you play around with it. You make it deeper, longer, as an experiment. You don't have to be like totally passive. You can engage the object of awareness. Or maybe you put more effort into the spine. You stretch the spine out, hold the spine stretched for a period of time to help you stay present.